Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:01 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 4th, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And there is a lot to talk about because I think we're seeing a really pivotal move going on right now in terms of what's happening with the dollar. And that is going to have a very significant knock-on effect for a whole range of asset classes, particularly from the perspective of an international investor. But one thing that I thought that would be particularly relevant to frame all of that conversation in is the fiscal response to the pandemic, because every country is running a deficit, and there has been this massive spending in order to try and shield economies from the economic impacts of the panicky response. And now we can see, for example, that Germany in particular has had a response in the region of about 40% of GDP. But a lot of that has been in the form of loan guarantees. So in the advent that we do see vaccines getting rolled out and this whole pandemic thing is in the rearview mirror, by the time we get towards the end of the first or even maybe perhaps the second quarter, then a lot of those loan guarantees may not be required. Nonetheless, the revenue and expenditure measures that have been deployed are extremely large by any stretch of the imagination, going up to about 7 or 8% of GDP in Germany, but about more than 10% in Japan. In the UK, it's about the 10% level. In Canada, it's among the highest of anywhere. And in fact, as a percentage of GDP, the revenue measures were in fact higher than the USA's. The USA's was also extremely large. But of course, then we have to consider that the USA is a much larger economy. So when we think about the quantity of money that is being printed in the USA in response to the issues arising from the lockdowns, then it's incredibly profound. Australia has also engaged in a massive fiscal stimulus, despite the fact that Australia has been extremely successful in curtailing the spread of the pandemic to one state. So obviously, people in Victoria have had to deal with lockdowns for a prolonged period, but Australia more generally has been highly successful in ensuring that it didn't spread much beyond Victoria. Then when we think about India and China, China has for the most part been spending via local governments, and that spending has been in the order of about 5%, but they have not been making loan guarantees to the wider economy. And there's a good reason for that too, because generally when China has engaged in providing guarantees in terms of loans, people have gone out and drawn down as much money as they possibly can and put it into all sorts of speculative ventures, and with absolutely no intention of ever paying it back. So the last thing that China is going to do is loan guarantees. Now, when we start to think about what all this means in terms of spending, I think it's probably more correct to simply look at the light blue portions of this chart, because the dark blue portions are guarantees, and we might never see the full drawdown on those guarantees, particularly as we start to see more economic activity starting to recover. 10-year Treasury yields are up to 92.9 basis points. This is a new recovery high. There has been a sequence of higher reaction lows since August. This has a rounding characteristic consistent with base formation development, and we're approaching the big psychological 1% level. And the chart at least says that we should anticipate that it's going to break on the upside. Now, one thing that I thought was really quite interesting is that there seems to be some reticence on behalf of investors, particularly on the bond side, to give any kind of credence to the view that we are going to have an inflationary response. And There is probably a reason for that, and it is that we didn't have a big CPI inflationary response to the massive amount of liquidity that was pumped into the market in the aftermath of the credit crisis. But a good reason for that was because banks were heavily impaired. And while the USA's banking sector has recovered in many respects, then it's been trending higher in a robust manner since 2009. It obviously pulled back in line with everything else, but it was one of a small number of instruments that had in fact been pushing new recovery highs in January before the pullback. It reacted rather early to the entire fear about the coronavirus and bottomed around the end of March. And since then, we continue to see this recovery. Now, there was news this week that a company called Stripe, which is a payments company, is partnering with a number of large e-commerce providers, but most particularly Shopify, to provide treasury management solutions. Now, what this in fact means is that they are making available banking facilities to e-commerce providers. Now, on the one hand, what that means is that Shopify is, and it is already providing these services to its subscribers, that, for example, they will make you a loan based upon your annual turnover, which is really rather accommodative, and the interest rates are very low. And of course, Shopify is bankrolling those types of loans by accessing facilities provided by Goldman Sachs and internationally via Citigroup and Barclays via Stripe. So Stripe is acting like an intermediary, but what it is also doing is going to other providers and offering them treasury solutions as well. What this is in effect doing is offering small businesses the opportunity to do layaway or pay over time solutions or vendor financing. And these are rather advanced financial transactions that wouldn't normally be available to reasonably small or mid-sized companies. But because this is all being made available, what it is in fact doing is creating a credit multiplier effect in e-commerce. And that isn't something that we've had before. So what there is the real potential now is that we are looking at a wholly different phenomenon. That historically, what would have been normal is that banks would have made decisions about how much money to lend and who to lend to. But what we're instead seeing is that that normal way of lending is more being taken on by governments and telling banks what to do with money that they're given. And then we have the e-commerce sector, which is a much more classic lender-creditor relationship, but it's massively influenced by the ease of doing business online. So we have the clear potential that credit is going to build up extremely quickly in the e-commerce sector. And that kind of multiplier effect is something that is directly inflationary. It's exactly the kind of credit multiplier that was completely absent in the aftermath of the credit crisis, and we are now getting it in the normal financial sector. Now, obviously, some of these e-commerce companies have done spectacularly well this year, but I think one doesn't really need to have a degree in chart analysis to see that Shopify has lost momentum, and it is pulling back now from the upper side of its range. In fact, if we look at the S&P 500 this year and look at the best performers, Etsy is the best performing share on the index this year. It's up in excess of 200%. And Etsy has done something that is really very beneficial for its sellers. It's doing the marketing for them. So you pay Etsy and it will market your products for you. Now that, of course, is something that is a very nice solution for sellers, and it has transformed the business for a large number of them, and by extension Etsy itself. But of course, it's also one of the companies that did spectacularly well as a result of the lockdowns. And as we look into 2021, well, it's hard to imagine that they're going to be capable of growing at the same rate in 2021. So we've had a spectacular advance, and these are still bull markets. This is still a high growth environment, but it's unlikely to grow quite as quickly as it has done in 2020 next year, or indeed the year after. But then we have to then start to think about, well, what is likely to do well? I think the biggest change that we've seen of late has been that the performance of Wall Street has been heavily influenced by the performance of the dollar. So the S&P 500 continues to push higher now over the course of this last month, and the dollar index has been pushing lower, and particularly over the last month. And this is not generally what investors have come to expect from investing in Wall Street, because over the course of the last decade, there were significant bull markets in, for example, Japan, and that was primarily driven by the debasement of the yen. And then it was only, the only way to play it was on a hedged basis, that people were hedging their yen exposure to gain exposure to the nominal price appreciation on the Nikkei. Then when we think about Europe, the only way that Europe was capable of rallying over much of the last decade was when there were active measures underway to devalue the euro. Well, what we've seen over the course of the last month is that both Japan and Europe have been able to rally, and rally in a dynamic manner, against a background where their currencies have been appreciating. But we're not seeing the same thing with the USA. USA's markets have also been rallying, but the currency is going down. So from the perspective of an international investor, often we look at international markets in US dollars, but if we look at the S&P in euros, well, then we are presented with a different pattern. And in fact, the market hasn't really gone anywhere at all for the last month. And when we think about that in terms of a yen investor, well, then we're presented with a somewhat better performance overall, but again, not nearly as impressive. But then let's just move that around and think about, well, what about Japan? And how are domestic and local investors doing there? Well, the Nikkei trended downwards for about 20 years, and then it started to turn around. It's been ranging below the 20,000 level between about 1992 and 2017, so 25 years. Then it put in a first step above that base, and it is now just pushing up and out of that range in local currency terms. But we should, I think, give some due consideration to the fact that the yen has been a strong currency over this last few years. So when we look at it in US dollar terms, it is accelerating out of this range, and it is within striking distance of pushing on to new all-time highs. When we then think about the TOPIX index, well, that has been going sideways in local currency terms for an awfully long time, but we're also really quite close to the peaks in US dollar terms, while it hasn't quite yet broken out of this almost 30-year range. But there are a significant number of indices globally that have broken out of their very long-term ranges. When we then think, I'm not entirely sure why that defaulted to 1967 to 1980, so let's just bring that up to date. The Taiwanese market peaked in 1989, early 1990, and went sideways until this year. So we're talking about a 30-year range. And now it is pushing on to new recovery highs. And this is against a background where the Taiwan dollar made a new high in here this week. It hasn't traded this high in 20-something years. So this is a completely different environment than we've seen for most of the last decade. We're now in an environment where the dollar is trending downwards. Asian currencies and emerging markets are trending upwards. The Asia Dollar Index has clearly broken its downtrend and it continues to extend that move. Of course, it did something similar between 2016 and 17 and then subsequently moved to a new low. So, in order to truly convince investors that this is not just a flash in the pan and that we are in fact moving into a more prolonged period of weakness in the dollar and strength in emerging markets and Asian currencies, it's going to have to find support at successively higher levels. And we haven't had a consolidation yet. Of course, a large part of that move is influenced by the renminbi. And the renminbi has been strengthening in no uncertain terms and was at another new high in here today. Until quite recently, it was looking like China was willing to devalue their currency. And that has suddenly turned around in the aftermath of the pandemic. For whatever reason, and certainly there has been a lot of debate, but China has been able to get control of the virus by hook or by crook, I think would probably be the best way to think about it. But the reality is that it is among the countries that have come out of the pandemic in better form, and that has contributed to the appreciation of the currency. There is obviously a number of different points that can be made about this. The first is that China is the largest import market for a substantial number of emerging markets, whether that is in terms of manufactured goods or commodities. So the strength of the renminbi takes pressure off of all of those emerging markets. They can allow their currencies to appreciate relative to the renminbi, and they come out looking rather well. It means then that trade can improve, their currencies can appreciate, and we get growth coming back into emerging markets. So the appreciation of the renminbi is certainly something that is likely to be beneficial for a large number of markets. And of course, then when we think about emerging markets, it is very difficult to invest outside of China because it represents such a large weighting among the currencies in the region, but also in terms of stock market participation. So the iShares Emerging Markets Index, or ETF, is coming back up towards the upper side of what is effectively a 12-year base formation. But it looks really quite similar to the H Share Index in Hong Kong, which has also been in a lengthy range, although more volatile, since about 2008 as well. As we think about what is likely, well, China's dearth of governance and increasing geopolitical tensions with the USA in particular, is likely to weigh on investor attitudes towards the region, and not least because of the risk that it isn't really about return on capital, but return of capital. So then investors will start to think about how to play China from a hedged perspective. And one of the ways to do that would be to invest in Asia ex Japan, or excuse me, Asia ex China. What's interesting is that there is a dearth of instruments that offer that kind of exposure because China has now got a large number of companies that occupy significant weightings in benchmarks, and therefore for a new suite of instruments to arise, we would need a new benchmark. And a benchmark that doesn't include China would obviously insult China, so then that's going to be a difficult prospect to bring to fruition. So then if we think about the outlook for individual markets, it may be necessary simply to invest in these individual markets. And Indonesia, for example, is rebounding now from the lows put in earlier this year. But I do think it's important to highlight that in US dollar terms, the Indonesian index is really just putting in a lengthy range above the long-term range that was completed back in 2010. The local currency chart looks completely different, and it demonstrates support around 4,000. When we then think about the Indian market, well, the Nifty is pushing on to new high ground, and it remains in a really very impressive secular bull market overall. India has demographics very much in its favor. It is really just on the cusp of developing a manufacturing sector. That is becoming urgent because the farming sector is becoming restive. So work will have to be found for excess labor in the agricultural sector. And if the economy is going to achieve its goals, then that will have to happen. So it's a needs must phenomenon. It's not just a nice to have any longer. So India is moving towards manufacturing. But it's important also to just look at how India has performed on a constant currency basis, because then we're looking at a different phenomenon, that India really did peak back in 2007 from the perspective of an international investor. And while there has been a great deal of volatility in between, the market has primarily gone sideways until now. And now it is pushing on to new all-time highs, both in local currency and in international terms. And obviously that's in US dollars, but if we just then think about it in euros or yen or pounds, it's also pushing up, and while not quite at a new high, it is doing better. So these are, I think, some of the opportunities that are out there, because as the dollar starts to come down, and it is perhaps worth just thinking about the consistency of the dollar's trend. Because when we look at dollars over the dollar index over the long term, there are a number of things that really stand out. The first is that the size of the moves on the upside are not consistent, but the length of time that they rally for is. So this one from the early 1980s all the way up to the peak was approximately 5 years. Then when it peaked and reached its terminal value at the lows was approximately 7 years. From that low in 92, well, then we had a rather impressive rally overall, and it went through all the way up until, and sorry, this, I need to make this in local currencies. Sorry about that. This rally was still 5 years. This was 7 years. Now we had a significant move up, and I think the trend really didn't get started until the retest of these lows. 95 through to approximately 2001 was approximately 6 years. Then we had this significant decline all the way down to 2008, so it was 7 years. If we think about the bull market starting again in 2011, then it peaked in 2017, so it's 6 years. So what we're looking at is 5 years on the upside and 7 years on the downside. Now, if it peaked in 2017 and it's 7 years on the downside, well, we're only just beginning to break downwards. we could be looking at a low for the dollar index in 2024. If we think instead that because the peak that we had in the period right at the beginning of this year was a new high, it was a new high in the Bloomberg dollar index, but not the conventional dollar index, and that's because of the relative weighting of the euro. But if we were to think that that is the peak in March of this year, and it was to range lower from here, or trend lower, I should say, then we could anticipate a low being found at some point in 2027. So we're really only at the beginning of a dollar bear trend. Rising yields are beginning to suggest that investors are cottoning on to that fact. And there is the clear potential that there's going to be a flight from the dollar and into other assets in a manner very similar to what we've seen during other dollar bear markets. It doesn't mean that US markets have to fall, but we will see a rotation. And obviously, the companies that have got large foreign earnings and that are repatriating those earnings and converting them back into dollars, well, they're likely to do rather well. And among those that tend to do well are the dividend aristocrats. So if we look at, for example, the Noble ETF, then it's pushing on to new high ground in no uncertain terms. And this is made up of the S&P 500 dividend aristocrats. Then when we think about emerging markets, they'll probably do better. And then, of course, we have gold. One of the things that is most important to remember about precious metals is that they're volatile and that they can be maddeningly frustrating to deal with, because it's exactly at the time when one allows oneself to become excited and enthusiastic about what the future holds that they tend to pull back. It's when one has been most disappointed and really frustrated with the failure of gold to do what one was anticipating, that usually is when they bottom. Well, there has been a lot of interest in gold as it comes back down towards the trend mean. And we had a meaningful rebound in here this week. But it may not yet be meaningful enough to confirm the low. We haven't seen the same kind of upward dynamics as we saw in size like we had at the lows back in March. And the preponderance of downward dynamics are also larger than the rebound we've seen just over the last few days. So we definitely have a low of at least near-term significance. Quite whether it is medium-term significance or not has yet to be confirmed. We have to at least also pay attention to the fact that gold is capable of going sideways for over a year before it reasserts on the upside. That's exactly what we had in the last bull market. When we think about the 18-month consolidations that we had all the way back in the period up from the lows in 2000, it went sideways for 18 months and broke out in September. Then it went, it had a really spectacular move on the upside, pulled back extremely violently, went sideways for 18 months and broke out in September, went sideways for 18 months again and then broke out in September. By that stage, people had gone through three of these scenarios. So the next time it pulled back violently, people were saying, well, I can just buy it now and it's at least going to break out in September. Of course, it did break out in September. Just on this occasion, didn't go through the whole 18-month consolidation first. And that marked an acceleration in that trend. So we're now in the region of that previous peak. It's a natural area where people might anticipate that support, some resistance would be found, some consolidation might occur. And that's exactly what we're getting right now. In order to clearly confirm that this is a low medium-term significance, we will need to see upside follow through next week. We'll need to see the low hold, and obviously then a sustained move above the 2000 level. One thing that I'm particularly attuned to and keeping a close eye on is the purchasing power parity adjusted gold chart, because we are really now only back in the region of the previous peak. This doesn't look like anything other than a consolidation. When we think about what is likely in terms of the weakness of the US dollar and the clear trend in terms of demand for hard assets, because the fact that the US dollar is going down is being met as an item of mild curiosity right now, because it's only just beginning. But by the time we get a couple of years into the dollar downtrend, then that is going to create urgency in terms of looking for alternatives, which is why it's so important now to pay attention to the potential for emerging markets to do well, the potential for commodities to pick up, and then also for gold to find support reasonably soon. We did have a very meaningful move off the lows in 2018, so we may yet see some additional consolidation, but at least we have a short-term low on which to hang hopes. But the one thing that's most important to remember about precious metals is, and commodities generally, is do not pay up for commodities, because they are volatile. They do have these swinging pullbacks, and those generally represent by far the best entry opportunities. It's also, you know, in terms of that baby steps way of participating in the market, leaving out some of the position on the accelerations on the upside is useful, because it at least ensures that we are not buying close to the peak in a new move. So one thing that we know is that even looking back at the history of gold, and gold in both the bull and a bear market scenario, it tends to adopt a sawtooth profile. And that means that there will be failures on the upside, there will be overextensions on the downside, and yet the upward bias will likely be held. When we then think about how silver is doing, well, silver does tend to lag in the first couple of years of a new bull market, and then it moves to outperformance subsequently. So silver is still above its trend mean, and it did rebound reasonably impressively this week. It's going to have to sustain a move above the $25 area in order to clearly confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. What we have, however, seen is that the industrial resources are beginning to pick up some of the running. Copper, for example, has rebounded in pretty emphatic fashion, and it is now pushing the highs posted back in 2016 and 17. So this is a meaningful move. But it's also, I think, important to look at the long-term chart, because it's another example of a commodity that had a spectacular breakout in the early part of the 2000s and then has been in this volatile range for most of the last 13 or 14 years. And now we're starting to see a response once more. With the aftermath of the pandemic, the clear intention of every government is reflation. And there is an extraordinary amount of money being devoted to that. The biggest infrastructure plans are coming out of Europe and China so far, and they're concentrating on a carbon neutral energy sector. So We've definitely seen renewed interest in renewable energy. In fact, it hasn't been this exciting from the perspective of investors since the period right ahead of the financial crisis in 2007. Back then, there was money for everything in the renewable energy sector because energy prices generally were very high. So that is the clear supply response to high prices. It encourages new forms of supply, new technologies into the market. That's exactly what happened with renewable energy and shale in the period ahead of the financial crisis. One thing that has happened is that the technology has been getting progressively better over the intervening 12 to 13 years, and now the renewable energy sector is capable of rallying without oil. But nonetheless, oil prices are doing better. And a lot of the reason for that is that it's about reflation in the short term, whereas the energy transformation that investors in renewable energy are hoping for is a very long-term solution. But one thing that we can think about is that it's going to cost trillions in terms of infrastructure and R&D in terms of how to commercialize green hydrogen technologies. But platinum prices are beginning to respond to that possibility, and they look like they have broken up and out of this base formation and are now pulling away from the $1,000 level for the first time, really, in at least the last 4 years. But platinum is the precious metal that is most depressed relative to its peak value, and particularly relative to palladium. When we think about the downtrend that platinum has put in versus palladium, it is really quite profound, and it exceeded the lows put in all the way back in 2002. So the only way to really characterize this is that platinum is still extremely cheap, and it is likely to, and just because it is a commodity that can be used in industrial processes, well, when a commodity is cheap, people will come up with ways to use it. That is, in fact, the primary reason behind the evolution of hydrogen, because natural gas is cheap right now, and it is still significantly below the peaks that were put in all the way back in 2005 and 2008. It's unlikely we're going to see prices sustainably above the $4 area for the foreseeable future. And in fact, we're moving into a seasonally weak period for natural gas overall. So I think there is clearly potential for a massive reflation trade, and that it will clearly favor markets ex the US because of the dollar phenomenon. It will favor the commodities sector in a significant way. When we think about the industrial metals, copper is doing well, and certainly the other industrial metals are doing well, but the mining companies are really only now just beginning to fire, and the BlackRock World Mining Trust has popped on the upside in here this week. It's being led by some of the copper miners. Antofagasta, for example, has clearly broken out and is now coming back to challenge the peaks put in all the way back in 2008. But then when we think about some of the other copper producers, Southern Copper is pushing on to new all-time highs. Then Glencore is going to get a new, I can't remember if it's a chairman or a CEO, but the share has rebounded in emphatic fashion over the last couple of days in particular. So we're definitely seeing increasing demand for industrial resources. That is about the potential for global reflation, but it's also about the evolution of demand. Because when we look at, for example, the determination of China to become the globally dominant provider of batteries, well, then lithium is a metal that is likely to come back into focus. It does look like it has now not just broken back above the trend mean for the first time in nearly 3 years, but that there is a clear rounding characteristic. It does look like it has found more than short-term support. Lithium was a hard sell back in 2012 and 13. Nobody really believed in batteries, but there was a lot of money poured into the energy or into developing new mines. Then Tesla's cars started to do rather well, and people started to become more interested. There was a lot of interest, but a lot of lithium came to the market, and prices came all the way back down again. Now we're starting to see gigafactories being developed all over the world, and every car manufacturer has got plans for new battery cars. So there is now increasing demand for lithium once more. It's also, I think interesting to think that when we look at the performance, for example, of Livent, which was hived off from FMC, it really didn't start to get going until back in March. It was really on the cusp of breaking out in the period right ahead of the pandemic, and things are now starting to fire once more. When we think about some of the other pure plays on lithium, they collapsed in line with the lithium price and are now starting to break up and out of their ranges. The agricultural commodities are also breaking out of bases. So there is the potential that we are entering a period of inflationary pressure. I remain very much of the opinion that there is a great deal of pent-up demand that is still sitting out there in the global economy. There is a lot of people that want to go on vacation. They want to get back to socializing. They want to enjoy life with their families and with friends, and getting out and into crowded situations and having a good time. And we are a social species overall. And then when we marry that with the fact that savings and personal income have increased on aggregate this year, then there is a lot of pent-up demand. When we think about what that means in terms of pent-up demand, well, my postbox has been peppered with cruise deals, and some of them have been highly attractive. And now we're seeing even the cruise liners are starting to recover. And Norwegian Cruise Lines was among the worst performers this year. This is also something we see at the end of every year, that some of the best performers lose momentum, and some of the worst performers, they generally tended to fall all the way into the end of the year. But it is looking like this year that we're seeing some book squaring, and sort of end of year tax selling has probably already taken place. That phenomenon is starting to become earlier and earlier. So the recoveries that generally would have started in January are now appear to be happening in December. We also have the fact that vaccines are going to become progressively more available. But then we also had the claim, at least this week, that Google has solved the protein folding problem. It isn't so much that this is going to result in immediate innovation, but it is something that has been plaguing the scientific community for a century. And the kind of advances that artificial intelligence are providing is really quite profound. And technology is going to provide a large number of solutions to problems that are plaguing society, but it's also part of the problem. And one of the things that we can certainly think about is that one of the reasons why there has been a rise in populism and is because of the rise of technology, and the ability to do more with less means that there has been less gainful employment for a good many people. The countries that seem to have done best in terms of social integration have strong manufacturing sectors. That's been true of Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and Germany. And it's been less so of places like the UK or the USA, which have been essentially denuded of their manufacturing sectors. The one thing that no one really seems to talk about anymore is that manufacturing jobs pay better, and that a lot of the low-end service jobs that have replaced the extractive industries and the manufacturing sectors in the Western world don't pay as well. And that fact that the better paying jobs have been exported and the fruits from those labors have been imported and only further increased the widening gap between the productivity of local and foreign workers, that has been one of the greatest factors in the rise of populism. Then, against all of that background, we have technological innovation and the evolution of subscription business models. And there has been a clear conclusion among institutional investors over most of the last 20 years that the purchasing power of individual consumers will continue to decline. When we hear people at the World Economic Forum telling the world that people will own nothing and still be happy, well, we're halfway there already, because the evolution of the sharing economy and of the subscription economy is something that is thriving on the parsing of the individual's monthly income into slivers. And that competition for slivers of income and the services that are being provided, where before people seemed to get along fine with owning stuff, now you don't own it, but you rent it. That was historically considered to be one of the greatest sources of inequality for poor people, that they couldn't afford their furniture, for example, but they had to get it on layaway. Even then, they didn't get it on layaway, they rented their furniture. And when they had a problem in their life, then they didn't have any furniture. Well, that was one of the symptoms of poverty. And we're potentially moving back in that direction, because the number of calls on income, the number of services that are being provided, has proliferated in the last year. So these are, I think, some of the factors that are going to have an impact. We also have to think about the fact that China has got approximately $3 trillion in reserves and about $1 trillion in U.S. treasuries, but they stopped buying U.S. treasuries in 2013, and that was the same year that they started out with the New Silk Road phenomenons. In other words, they gave up lending to the U.S. government and instead lent to emerging markets. When one looks at the kinds of practices that have been put in place and the infrastructure built and the way that those contracts have been structured, it means that China takes over those pieces of infrastructure if payments are not sustained. And that is a very meaningful geopolitical event. We're really only just starting to see the ramifications of now, because with the dollar starting to deteriorate and yields starting to rise, then this incredible pace of technological innovation also has geopolitical consequences. As we look at the global order and we think about commodities and what they mean in terms of the global order. The clear determination of both China and Europe to evolve into carbon free economies is not just about global warming. It's certainly being sold like that, but it also neatly solves the problem of dependence on US dollars and also on imports of energy. It's a geopolitical phenomenon. If one can become energy independent in the same way that the USA has, or energy independent in any way, as long as it represents independence, then it's a massive geopolitical coup. And that has been one of the other big changes. So not only is China no longer buying treasuries, but they are also trying to wean themselves off of energy. They're becoming more assertive internationally, and they are enforcing their will on neighboring countries. They're demanding that they get loyalty from countries that they deal with. This is resulting in acrimonious disputes with, for example, India and Australia. But then we can think about what's happening with both Japan and South Korea, and to many respects Taiwan, where the relationships are getting closer. So we are most certainly moving in the direction of a multipolar world, and that does hold out the prospect for more conflict. If we think about readiness, then independence in terms of oil and securing supply lines for commodities, those are rear guard actions, and they are preparations for war. Therefore, China will probably be ready for war at some point in the early 2030s. Obvious conclusion, therefore, is if one is going to inevitably have a war, then the best thing to do would be to curtail one's opponent from reaching readiness, and that is why we have a trade war. And as we look at the willingness of the Biden administration to pursue China's expansionism internationally, and their refusal to buy U.S. treasuries on top of that, then we can think about those longer-term objectives. There is just no way that the USA is going to abandon its trade war, and it does mean that we are going to move into a more aggressive scenario. But what it means for countries in between, that there's probably good money playing one off the other, and emerging markets will probably do well in the competition between the great powers, and that there is clear potential for commodities and gold to price in the potential we are moving into a period of great power competition, where there will be a great deal of demand for infrastructure and energy of all sorts. Eventually, we're going to see that inflationary pressures start to rise, if that does indeed be the case, because we get less efficient global networks, we get more competition for resources, we get more nearshoring to try and become more independent and secure supply lines, and the inefficiency of all of those types of factors, they do contribute to inflation. And on top of that, we have new credit multiplier phenomenon being supplied by the fintech community. Then when we think about the outlook for Bitcoin, well, it has done spectacularly well in a very short period of time, which is what it does. I think that trading Bitcoin is quite similar to trading any other commodity, and that you do not pay up, and that it is liable to have these significant pullbacks. And when it has significant pullbacks, then if one is going to participate, that is an opportune time. The one thing that is important to realize about Bitcoin is the vast majority of the mining rigs are in China. And in many respects, it is a Chinese cryptocurrency. So that is a risk, because if China really did want to enforce their own digital currency and to cut out competition from other currencies, they could potentially do it. Now, that is obviously a statement that is going to be very heavily objected to by the crypto community. But when we think about the control of nodes and the number of nodes that would need to be controlled to have a very clear effect on Bitcoin, then it is possible for China to control the system. And when we look at the trend, it's a little overbought, and as we look at the peak, it's in the region of the peak from back in 2016-17. When gold got to its peak, it pulled back and had a period of consolidation, and I think that that is now what we're seeing with Bitcoin. But the interest in a hedge against dollar devaluation is as positive for Bitcoin as it is for gold. And the clear intention to move money beyond the ability of governments to tax it is likely to be beneficial for both assets over time. There is going to be a clear demand for taxation, and there is already a war on cash because Treasury yields are rising. The demand for, and this has been potentially the end of a very profound bear market. The one difference that Europe and the USA have with Japan is that, from the USA's perspective in particular, it doesn't have the trade surplus that Japan has. So then there is also the willingness to simply print as much money as is required. They know exactly what's happened to Japan. They're going to be willing to do whatever it takes to avoid that outcome. And that suggests that we are going to see a great deal of money printed over the next few years. Because with the potential for the dollar to break down, it's already pricing in that eventuality, and that quantity of additional cash coming into the system is plenty big enough to support bull markets. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.